Good morning. I want to welcome you all to our personal theology speaker series. I see some new faces here. This is a weekly series, and we have a variety of topics related to theology and spirituality, different speakers each week. So this week, we're happy to welcome back Dr. Stephen Herman, who has spoken here a number of times in the past, and he's also given some fascinating workshops, so we may get him to do that in the future. Stephen is a Jungian psychotherapist who's been practicing for over 28 years, and he has a clinical practice in Oakland, and he uses dream work, journaling, and poetry, among other therapeutic methods. He's taught courses at the Jung Institute in San Francisco, Chicago, and Zurich, as well as at UC Berkeley, UC Santa Cruz, and at Yale. Stephen is also a nationally and internationally recognized writer, and he's the author of four books, which we have three of them for sale over here following the presentation, and they're a great bargain because he's selling them all for $20 right now, and they're much more expensive than that normally. So, and he also has 30 publications besides his books, and his writings reflect his avid studies on C.G. Jung, Teilhard de Chardin, Meister Eckhart, and Swami Vivekananda, as well as the writings of Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, and Emily Dickinson. So today, Stephen is going to talk to us about vocational dreams. So let's give a very warm welcome to Stephen Herman.
Thank you very much, Barbara. Lonnie, hello. So, what are vocational dreams? Has anyone had a vocational dream? Oh, I see some hands here. I would venture to say that probably all of you have had a vocational dream of some kind or another. Whether you're aware of it or not, we dream every 90 minutes when we're asleep. Rapid eye movements, and we don't always recall our dreams. So the key is to catch them when we can, and in whatever way we can. And this is a subject that is very close to my personal interests. I started researching vocational dreams by coincidence. When I was at UC Santa Cruz, I was put in charge of teaching Carl Jung's theories of dream interpretation to classes of 100 students who were all in the process of trying to see if they could confirm their vocation through their dream life. Can you hear me all right there? Yeah. Okay. The aim of the course was to see if you could confirm your vocation by looking at dreams over the course of a quarter. This was a class taught by the poet William Everson, and I worked for him for 2 years and remained his good friend at the university. And then later I would go down and we would have conversations. The conversations that focused on vocation ended up becoming a transcript of the book that I wrote with Bill Everson, The Shaman's Call. I'm going to be speaking a little bit today about the way in which dreams can become part of our psychophysical experience, our reality. I'm going to do that by bringing in a few ideas from my studies in Jungian psychology and Carl Jung's theory of synchronicity. Because oftentimes when we tap into a vocational dream at a deep enough level, it touches a corresponding chord in the collective psyche or transpersonal unconscious. And whenever that happens, it can create a reshuffling of environmental events whereby things can happen to us that are beyond probability and are based on what Jung called meaningful chance. This is an acausal connecting principle, he said, in the universe that proves that there's a hidden, quote, hidden correspondence between deep underlying archetypal nuclei in the psyche and outer events that happen that are sometimes baffling and can startle us and leave us with a feeling of something numinous, as he said, something that leaves us feeling with a sense that there's a sense of the holy present. This comes from Rudolf Otto's book, The Idea of the Holy. Jung took that idea that he used in his lectures at Yale University on psychology and religion. It was his last trip to the United States in 1937, where he talked about this. I'm going to be talking about some pretty heady ideas this morning. But I want to put that aside for a moment and just reflect for a minute on some questions. What is your vocation? I want you each to take a minute to reflect on that question and see if you can maybe close your eyes for a minute and just meditate on that question and see if any image or feeling comes to mind, some reverie, perhaps a memory from early childhood, your adolescence perhaps.
Stephen, you're not necessarily talking about our work, our current work, when you say vocation, right?
You know, practical questions like that always help me get grounded. So thank you. Am I talking about jobs and, you know, careers that are focused on money? Sometimes it can correspond with that. But no, I'm not talking about jobs in the sense of work. And to hold the opposites on this and be non-dual, I am. It's a mystery and it's a paradox that sometimes we can be doing something in our lives that we think is not really our true calling. We may be wanting to do something else in the moment and neglect to see... It was the wind. You know, this morning I was out running, and the wind was just really blowing up in the Oakland Hills, and the fall is here, so there it is. Speaking of synchronicities here. No, I had a dream this morning, Barbara, and I'll share it with you. Because it relates to this question of calling. I was getting notes together for my presentation this morning. It's about 6 o'clock. I hadn't checked my email. Barbara had written me apparently, and I hadn't checked my email yet. But I had all these notes, and it was a lot of intellectual material, and I have been actually preparing for this talk for the last 4 months, and I had my notes and everything I was going to read from this morning, which I conveniently forgot at home. And I'll tell you why, because in the dream, I was exhausted. I was tired of all this heady work I had been doing. And I wanted to do was go to the park and go for a run in the park and get out of the head and into the body. So I went to the park, and I started to, it was almost like I was on these skis, like cross-country skis, but I was running. And I noticed all these redwood pieces that had been cut and oak leaves and branches that had been trimmed. And I thought, well, wow, what's happening here? I wonder who's doing this. And as I kept running through the trail, on the trail, through the park, I came to a hill, and on the hill I heard some voices. And there was, three women and a man. They were all park rangers. And they were up there just having a good time and talking together, doing their work. They were clearing the forest. And I looked at my watch, and I noticed it was 9 o'clock. And I said, oh, my goodness, I better get moving because Barbara said to be here at 9:15. So it's one of those panic dreams. And then I overheard the female park ranger, the head park ranger, say to the man when he asked her what time it was, he said it was 9:15. And I said, oh my, now I'm really in. So I woke up. It was one of those anxiety dreams, right? And I ended up going for a run this morning in the park. And it did energize me. And it reminded me that, first of all, I was a track runner in high school. So I went to the state meet in California. We took fourth in California in the state mile relay. So running was always important to me. Being in nature was always important. It was part of a vocation. But who was the park ranger? So I got into a little dialogue this morning with the park ranger. And this is what Jung would call the anima, okay, the feminine principle in the masculine psyche. Marie-Louise von Franz, a very close associate and scholar in Jungian psychology, wrote in her book on typology that the inferior function is the doorway to the collective unconscious. Wow, that's a great statement. Now, a park ranger, oftentimes the typology, psychological type of the park ranger is sensation, because it's, you know, a very grounded, in-the-world kind of activity. So I'm an intuitive type. So this would be my introverted, inferior function, the anima function. So it also got me reflecting on something you said, Barbara, in your email exchange at the beginning of the summer about this course. And if it's okay, I'll share it. And that's that Barbara mentioned that she doesn't think she just has one vocation, something to that effect, correct? And I began to think about vocations in a different way after that exchange. I began to think about what I was reading at the time, which was William James on the varieties of religious experience and pragmatism, and what James called in his last book the pluralistic universe. He talked about vocations in a pluralistic way, that there are many vocations, that we have many callings. The word vocation comes from the Latin root vocare, which means to be summoned or called beyond the known. It's something that takes us out of our everyday, ordinary consciousness and pitches us into a transcendent or transpersonal state. Now, I've been thinking lately about vocation from the standpoint of archetypal psychology. And what I've come up with is that this is a hypothesis I developed at John F. Kennedy University. I was, after my work at Santa Cruz, I got my master's degree in clinical psychology at JFKU. And for my study, I did a master's thesis on 10 individuals who I interviewed who had a vocational dream in early adulthood. Each one of these individuals had the dream that they could trace back to early childhood memories. So I began to think differently at that point about this notion of a calling. That there's some correspondence between early childhood reveries or fantasies and a future vocational choice. And speaking of park rangers, one of them was a young man who was in the restaurant where I was working at the time, cooking my way through college. And I would talk to him and met him for this interview. He had wanted to be a park ranger, and he was frustrated and was feeling like he wanted to get back to school and live out what he really wanted to do in life. Now, when I asked him about the interest, where it developed, it was very interesting what I learned, that the vocational dream was that he was a park ranger on Mount Diablo in near Walnut Creek, where I grew up, right in the Bay Area here. His mother had died when he was an adolescent, and they had scattered her ashes on Mount Diablo. So you see this correspondence. He wanted to be a park ranger and work close to the place where he felt connected with nature and with something larger than himself. Another interesting association I have to the park ranger motif is the interviews I did with Bill Everson. I had the good fortune of being able to look at these dream journals that students would submit after each quarter, and then they would write a final paper trying to make a correlation between a dream and their vocational interest. In the case of one young man who was getting his bachelor's degree in biology, in the physical sciences, he had seven or eight dreams over the course of a quarter that he wanted to be like John Muir and go to the Sierras and become a park ranger. And on the basis of those dreams, he left the university and pursued his calling as a park ranger. Now, during the research at Kennedy, I must say there was a something drawing me, and that's what I think is the key factor in vocational development. Not where your talents are. That's what Bill Everson used to tell me. Your calling is not where your talents are. It's where your motivation is. It's where your sense of energy is, psychic energy. What moves you? Where do you feel pulled the most? I had an opportunity to talk yesterday at a teaching institution here in the Bay Area, and I turned it down. I'm not sure why I did. But I didn't feel motivated. I did feel motivated to come here this morning and talk about this subject. One of the most famous dreams in science that some of you may know about, Glory, you probably do. This is the dream of the physicist Niels Bohr. He was trying to determine the structure of the atom. He went to sleep and he dreamt. He was standing in the boiling gaseous center of the sun, and around him were these nine planets that were revolving in their course. He woke up. He said that the atom has a nucleus, and around it are these revolving particles that he called electrons. Now, he won the Nobel Prize for that discovery in science. It's often true that in scientific discoveries, these kinds of breakthroughs happen through a dream. Another example is the Czech chemist Kekula, who dreamt that Actually, it was a reverie. He was trying to determine the nature of the benzene ring. Is it an open or a closed carbon structure? He went to sleep, dreamt that he saw a snake that suddenly was going in a circle, and suddenly it bit onto its tail and formed the symbol of the Ouroboros in alchemy, this circular serpent that's biting its own tail. He woke up, he said it was a closed carbon structure, and presented that hypothesis to the scientific community, and he won the prize for chemistry. And then he said, "Now, gentlemen, may you learn how to dream." Of course, it was a bit gender biased, I think, that he said men, but now the climate's changed a little in science, I think. But nevertheless, it shows the power of the unconscious and the remarkable insights that can come in an intuitive way through flashes of sudden understanding, that knowledge is transmitted through the unconscious in some kind of way. Those are two examples from science. Yes. Well, that's a very good question, Lonnie. I think it can be approached through intention. And that's the way that, of course, I was approaching the subject when I was looking at it in my own dreams. I don't think everybody goes at it in quite that way. I don't think that Bohr expected to discover that hypothesis through a dream. And he may have... He was working hard. You see, when in science, when you have a discursive reason, what Jung called directed thinking, you work very, very hard with intellectual intention on a subject, and then you let go. And what happens is that fantasy thinking takes over, a different function. The imagination, the creative imagination. And when this different faculty begins to take over, then things can happen. Let me tell you personally, Lonnie, what I was doing at UC Santa Cruz and at Kennedy. I had been studying the scientific research on dreams and rapid eye movements and their circadian rhythms, and learned that there were dream cycles that happen every 90 minutes. So I decided that I was going to start setting my alarm clock for 4.5 hours after I went to sleep each morning. And I would go to sleep and set my alarm clock for 4:44 a.m. and every time I would wake up at that time, the alarm clock would ring. I would come out of a dream cycle. I had timed it that closely. And I could catch my dreams. Now, you all know the symbol of the dream catchers, you know, the Native American dream catchers. Catching dreams is as an art and a science. And I think it needs to be cultivated as a discipline, as one would meditation, as one would contemplation. So clearly I was using intention in trying to catch these dreams when I was doing my own research. And one of the dreams that broke through as I was beginning to look objectively at this phenomenon in these interviews. Actually, it wasn't even before I started the interviews. It was when I first got the idea that this is what I was going to do. I had a dream. And in the dream, I found myself in my second grade classroom. And the instructor, Mrs. Rasmussen, who was my second grade teacher, was reading stories to the class from the Native American Indians. And one of the stories was the story of the Vision Quest, which is a rite of passage for youth to specifically, through intention, go out and cry for a vision. Hanblachaya in Lakota Sioux, it's this idea of lament. Black Elk speaks about this in the book The Sacred Pipe, when he talks about the seven rites of the Oglala Sioux, that the third rite was called crying for a vision. Now, we underestimate the significance of the crying metaphor. They meant it in a literal way. It's not just symbolic. To fast for 3 days, three nights, 4 days, no water, no food on a lonely mountaintop, and to ask the Great Spirit for a vision is no easy task. And so it really was an ordeal. And I learned about this in the second grade. And I didn't remember this until I had the dream. And somehow it all began to make sense, how I got interested in this subject. That it was always something from the age of 7 to the time I was doing my research in my late 20s, mid to late 20s, I was really seeking a vision that had already been awakened in me at an earlier age, and I didn't even know it. So dreams can do this for us. They can help us remember. They can help us remember those spots of time, as the poet Wordsworth said, that are unique to our childhood. And it's out of that that these images come of our immortality, that we have come from, you know, that wonderful passage of Wordsworth's. Trails of glory do we come from God that is our home, I suppose it's, I don't have the exact quote. But he remembered as a boy himself going out onto the lake and hearing the owls hooting to him on the lake. And that resonance helped him become a romantic nature poet. Those early reveries. There's a marvelous book on this by the phenomenologist, philosopher Gaston Bachelard, The Poetics of Reverie. There's a chapter in there called Reveries on Childhood. And he talks about the French poets and how each of them had these reveries from early childhood. That really spoke to me when I read that, because then I remembered how I'd seen this in the data that I had studied and also in my own dreams and memories. I taught for 5 years in the career development program at John F. Kennedy University, the School of Business Management, School of Management. And I taught this course once. It's very different now. Feels very different. I taught the Myers-Briggs type indicator as well. So there was a lot of focus there, of course, on careers and jobs and money, how to make money. Cash value, that's the word that William James used. How do you create cash value out of your interest and motivation? You know, in a way, we live in a democracy that values the economic strata perhaps more than it definitely does, more than the spiritual level. that I write about in my book on spiritual democracy. And also the political, right now the political is very up, political level of democracy. But the economic strata is running the country. You see it in big pharmaceutical industry. You see it in my field of psychology, psychotherapy, how, you know, the DSM-5 and, you know, big pill industries are running the profession in a way, psychiatry. We've gotten away from the importance, I think, of looking within. Looking within for answers and asking our unconscious questions. This is a dialogue that we can engage in this back and forth, this dialectic about what is my calling? You know, what is my vocation? Just the question itself evokes a certain kind of reverie, a certain kind of meditation, a reflection on what it is that really moves us. And the deeper we go into that question, the more doors begin to open. These are what William James called the subliminal door. I'm speaking about it pluralistically. He mentions it in a singular way in varieties of religious experience. I've been thinking about it more pluralistically recently because I do think that there are many doors that can open up to the cosmos or to the inner cosmic consciousness that we can enter into when you walk through one of these doors, pass through one of these doors. The dream, Jung said, is a little hidden door in the innermost and most secret recesses of the soul, opening into that cosmic night which was psyche long before there was any ego consciousness and which will remain psyche no matter how far our ego consciousness may extend. In dreams, we put on the form of that more real, truer, more eternal man or woman dwelling in the darkness of primordial night. So you see how Jung was using that metaphor as well. Now, where did Jung get this metaphor? Was it from his reading of William James and his meeting with William James in 1909 when he came to Clark University and met him? Or in 1910 when he met him the following year? Jung met him three times. I would venture to say that there was an influence. Whether it was direct transmission through his reading of James or through the conversations, I don't know. But one thing's clear, that when Jung broke away from Freud, William James played an important role as a fatherly friend, an elderly fatherly friend. He was 35 years older than Jung. Iverson was 44 years older than I was when I met him. He was definitely the archetype of the wise old man incarnate. He was like a Christ or a Buddha figure to me. And I learned from him how to sit at a master's feet and take instruction about a subject. And the subject was vocational dreams. Now, Jung, you know, was a great follower of Freud for a period of time. In fact, Freud saw him as his, quote, crown prince, that Jung was going to carry psychoanalysis into the 20th century, 21st century. And Jung was determined that he was going to follow his own way. Because he had his own points of view, difficulties arose. Freud was very interested in preserving his authority in the dialogue with Jung. And Jung didn't like that. He didn't like the authority piece. And so there was a rupture in the friendship. And Jung then fell into a bad state. We could say he got into a depression. And what did he do? He followed the emotions. He had already developed this idea of complexes, that they're affect-toned. And so in order to get at the image contained in the emotions, which is a psychotherapeutic process, he engaged in this dialogue with his unconscious. He called it active imagination. Now, the most famous dream, now that we have Jung's Red Book, some of you may have seen the Red Book or heard about it. You can see pictures of this figure, this winged being called Philemon. Now, Philemon came to Jung first in a dream. The dreams were, it was written down in the Black Book, which was used to, as the template for what's now the Red Book. So he, in the Black Books, you can see that Jung had this this dream where he was looking out at the sky and a winged being was flying across the sky. He had kingfisher's wings. You know the kingfisher, the bird? It had that same color. And he had bull's horns. And he was carrying four keys and had his hand outstretched. And one of the keys, as if he was going to open a door. So Jung didn't understand the dream. So in order to understand it, what he thought he would do is to begin painting it. So for those of you who are artists, you know the power of that form of expression. It opened Jung up to a kind of a dialogue with Philemon. And what he learned is that Philemon's thoughts were not his. That Philemon had what he called objectivity, psychic objectivity, or the reality of the psyche. That he had transpersonal thoughts that were not Jung's. And so in order to engage in this dialogue, he had to realize that there was a superior personality. He called this personality number two. Personality number one was Carl Jung, the psychiatrist, you know, the family man, you know, more the one who was more into the job, perhaps. But this other side of him transmitted something to him through a door of some kind. Philemon opened the door for Jung to the transpersonal unconscious. At first, he called it collective or transpersonal unconscious. This is the way it's translated by the editors of the collected works. The German word is überpersönlich, which means auf Deutsch or in German, over the personal or above the personal. Transpersonal suggests beyond the personal. So it's important to get this distinction. Philemon was a being from the upper world or from the superconscious, I would say. He connected Jung to the transpersonal psyche. Now, I did say something about synchronicity in the beginning of my talk this morning that I'd say a few words about it. Let me just give you an example quickly. And it comes again from Jung's autobiography. When he was in the process of painting this figure, Philemon, he went out into his garden and he found in the garden a dead kingfisher. Now, kingfishers are very rare in the vicinity of Zurich and Küsnacht, Switzerland. So the probability of finding this bird in his garden at that precise moment is beyond it's beyond the probable. So it was baffling, as he said. There must have been some connection to the image, the archetype he was then portraying. So he began to reflect even then in 1914 on these coincidences that were crossing his path now and then, when an archetype was constellated. Now, when we're talking about vocation, we're talking about vocational archetypes. When these archetypes get activated, they can create, they can constellate, is the right word, events that are completely improbable. Let me give you another example from my own life. So I told you about my experience in the second grade with Miss Rasmussen. You know, the Native Americans, they talk about power animals or totem animals. Well, at seven, I caught my first California king snake. Same year. And I have had, I can't even count how many dreams about this snake. I've been keeping a dream journal for 40 years. I think I probably have logged 15,700 dreams, 7% of which I can only estimate have been vocational. Now, I don't know how many of these dreams have involved the king snake, maybe 100. But I was going to the graduation for my PhD diploma. It was the graduation ceremony, 1995. I was living in the Arinda Hills, just on the other side of the tunnel here. And I was heading up towards Tilden Park, and I was coming around the turn, and right in the road, as I was coming up Alta Vista Drive, was a 4.5-foot king snake stretched out right across the pavement. And I swerved a bit to try and miss the snake, but I nicked its tail just a little bit. The snake coiled up in a circle really quickly and was protecting its tail. And I saw this as I was driving in my rearview mirror, so I stopped my car, put it in reverse, came down, saw the snake, opened my door, picked it up with my left hand, put it on my lap, and drove up to my house. My friend, the day before, had given me an aquarium. I didn't know why he had given this to me. But I thought, well, this is, you know, I like snakes. Maybe I'll put something in it. Now, I hadn't seen a snake in the wild for 20 years. So why on that particular day, at that particular moment, did that event happen when I was having these dreams right around the same time? And it was, you know, during weddings, a birth, a death, parapsychological phenomenon sometimes happen to us. And many of you have experiences with this, that sometimes something happens that really startles us. That was a startling event. I kept it for about 3 days, gave it some water after it bit me on the hand, and then I let it go. But it was meaningful to have it for those 3 days during that time. It brought back a lot of memories. Yes, Lonnie. You just read my mind, Lonnie. Yes.
I went to a Jungian therapist because I was interested in dreams. Mm-hmm. And I had a dream where there was, now in my 20s, I was really cute and fashionable and, you know, just a little hotsy-totsy thing. And I had this dream that I, thank you, Linda, that I was sitting and behind me was sitting a white cowboy. East Texas type. And I never, and he was saying, well, I don't talk so good, and, you know, and I mean, just everything that was skeeving me, you know, about racism and all that legacy meant.
Oh, wow.
And I was young, and I had never understood what that dream was until you just said about the inferior function. Mm-hmm. Because subsequently, I began to really love country western lyrics, which I never told anybody. And I began to write country western songs under a pseudonym.
Wow.
Please don't tell anybody. And I learned about plain speaking, which is what I think the Texan cowboy in my vision, uneducated, unfettered by certain intellectual and, you know, and that part of me, that very inferior part, mm-hmm. has come up as plain speaking.
Yeah.
And I plain speak here, and so, and it has really guided my life, but I never understood why this cowboy came until you just said about the inferior function.
Thank you for that, Lonnie. That really, I think, answers the question for a lot of people here about this connection to the inferior function, because it's through the speaking. You see, the word vocation means to be addressed by a voice. So the speaking of that cowboy, that voice, that inflection of the word, you know, the word in with a capital W, the word of God can come through the inferior function. I learned this through Everson's meditation technique. He was a Dominican for 18 years, so he learned directly from the Dominicans this art of meditation on a theme, that you start with a certain theme and you continue to deepen the subject through the linguistic channel. You go down to the very ground of being, as they say. And Meister Eckhart taught me more than anybody about this connection to the word. I wrote my senior thesis on Meister Eckhart under Everson's tutelage. And Eckhart was probably my greatest teacher at UC Santa Cruz, next to Everson and Jung, of course. But thank you for that, Lonnie. I think that where you read my mind was that I was thinking about that park ranger this morning in my dream. Yeah. And the way in which she represents my connection to nature, because I've been planting redwood trees in Joaquin Miller Park just behind my home. I think I have 55 trees now back there. And I was just looking at one this morning and marveling. It's 7 feet tall now. I started with little, very small baby redwoods. And just to see them grow during the drought, by the way, the 4 years of drought, and I had to water them each by hand just to keep them alive, it's rewarding, you know. And we each do our little part, you know. As those park rangers were this morning, they were each clearing their little part of the forest, but doing their work, their job. And that's where the job can become a real calling. Barbara.
Stephen, in just a few minutes, we should stop and
sure.
have questions from
okay.
the audience. So if you want to kind of...
Yeah, let me see if I can wind this up a little bit. Okay. I'll tell you a dream that I had at UC Santa Cruz. I was in a very large cathedral. I don't know where it was, but it reminded me of Notre Dame in Paris. And there were the stained glass windows, and I was sitting in my pew with my wife, my ex-wife. We were side by side, and I was kneeling, but very grounded, you know, on the pew. And there was there was a deacon, a woman, deacon. And she had brown eyes, and she was looking between me and this light that was suddenly filtering in through the stained glass. Now, when the light filtered through the stained glass, it hit her eye, and then it refracted and entered my psyche and through my eyes. And suddenly, it's as if I ascended straight up through the top of the cathedral, through the roof, and went up into the sky, and I was looking straight across at the resurrected, you know, the glorified Jesus, like those paintings you see in Europe of the transfigured Christ. And we were meeting eyes, and it was a very numinous kind of experience. So I had this dream while I was reading Meister Eckhart. Now, Meister Eckhart had actually taught at Notre Dame, and I had been to Notre Dame when I was about 11. So that was the first Catholic church, and probably, well, it wasn't the last, but it was the first Catholic church I'd ever been in. So my mother was Catholic, so there's a certain ancestry along the maternal line with Paris and with Meister Eckhart teaching in Paris and then this experience. Now, what stands out in your minds? This is 1981, about the image or the dream, other than, you know, the mystical part connected to me, but about the deacon. Does anyone have any thoughts about that?
When I was in France, I was with a bunch of creative writers who said they were inspired, and one of the things they were inspired by was the Notre Dame Cathedral. And much later, I was studying Egyptology, and I discovered that there was a Notre Dame earlier than that cathedral, and that cathedral was built on the site of a temple of Isis.
Wow.
And these writers that I was talking to, they were all atheists. But nevertheless, it turned out that that place, that inspiring place, mm-hmm. had at one time been inhabited by a different deity.
Thank you for that. I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else have an idea?
Two comments. The temple that he's referring to has a spring in it, which is down on still under Notre Dame. Fascinating. My other reflection on it, there is no place in Catholic services for a female deacon.
Thank you. Exactly. Now, that was in 1981. I just heard from my friend Matthew Fox that Pope Francis has now, I believe, ordained six female deacons. So you see, dreams of a vocational nature can also be what Jung called prospective. In other words, they anticipate in the future something that's going to happen. This is not prophetic. It's anticipatory. It suggests certain lines of probability into the future, but it doesn't tell you exactly in every detail how it will correspond to reality. But there is definitely some kind of correspondence there, both to what you're talking about with regards to the Catholic Church and the deacons, but also this interesting connection with Isis that I did not know about. The Isis temple, that there's a feminine personality there that is the mediator, and it's through her eyes that this different kind of consciousness, a transcendent consciousness, can be achieved in the psyche of a man. Now, it could be It could be the Texan cowboy, or it could be, a Unitarian minister. But this idea that we have a doorway through the anima or the animus in the male or female psyche, you see how Jung's idea really opened us up to some kind of new way of looking at religious experience, spiritual phenomenon. But Meister Eckhart, as you know, he had around him a group of women. They were called the Beguines, and they took down his sermons and his tractates. So they were the ones who preserved his writings for posterity. And so the feminine, and he talked about a fourth principle beyond the Trinity, which he called die Gottheit, which in German translates as the Godhead, but with a feminine, die Gottheit, not der, but die. You know, it's a feminine principle. So it connects us to the ground and to the sky as well. And Isis is an interesting figure. I'd like to hear more thoughts about what you think.
Shall we go on to questions? Wait for the microphone. The sense that the light was coming through a stained glass window,
yes,
and was brightly colored,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
rather than the sense of like whiteness that, mm-hmm, we think of as the Godhead,
mm-hmm,
that it was you were in a darkened space, which,
mm-hmm,
is what,
mm-hmm,
Notre Dame is like, and,
yeah,
those windows are particularly amazing,
yeah.
And that the light was shining into a woman's eyes.
Yes.
A deacon,
mm-hmm,
woman's eyes,
mm-hmm,
and then into your eyes next to,
mm-hmm,
a woman whom you have been intimately related.
Yes, the mother of my son.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then, mm-hmm, that would be the spark.
The spark.
I mean, I've had like 5 years of animus dreams,
mm-hmm,
and some people we know don't care much for anima,
uh-huh,
but wow,
the spark of the soul,
that is
deep.
Amazing. Yes, that was what I wrote down, was not spirit,
mm-hmm,
but soul
spark.
That it's something,
mm-hmm,
feminine and deep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, questions? Now,
yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Ready
questions,
for questions?
Anybody or comments?
Hi, my name is Sweta, and I've never been here before at all. I found a random message on Nextdoor,
mm-hmm,
and I felt called to come. And now I kind of know why. So, mm-hmm, this morning I was meditating,
mm-hmm,
and the message that came through for me was, be the vessel of the Divine Mother.
Wow.
And it's like I'm coming here, and the signs are so strong. You know, like, I moved to California because of the redwoods.
Because of?
The redwoods.
The redwoods.
One time, just recently, my husband and I went away for our anniversary, and we're going out to dinner, and we stumbled upon a temple of Isis.
Hmm.
A whole temple dedicated to Isis.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, why am I here?
Mm-hmm.
And then, just also when you're talking about the animals as well, I think I came in late, so I don't know what the inferior dream,
mm-hmm,
is, but what I'm getting,
mm-hmm,
is that animal totems come to me a lot. So,
mm-hmm,
the owl is also another reason why I moved here.
Mm.
And now the turtle's coming to me.
Mm.
My sense is that, as this is unfolding, is that the owl was my mother's lineage, and that the turtle is my father's lineage.
Mm.
But so I always thought the owl was my totem.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a deep fear of cats. And it's because I was attacked by a cat when I was 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I have dreams of cats all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had a dream of an owl or a turtle.
Uh-huh.
And I've almost run over a cat a few times the past, mm-hmm, few weeks. And so it's kind of coming together,
mm-hmm,
now, you know, which is this this is my vocation, mm-hmm. I would guess you would say, or my calling is this real embodiment of the divine feminine mm-hmm. and the divine mother in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And so my sense is in that dream, mm-hmm. it was just the divine mother like calling you.
Mm-hmm.
And the work that I've done with the divine mother has been all around forgiveness and compassion. Mm-hmm. And that when she comes to people, it's because that's what they're, that's what they need.
Uh-huh.
And she's ready to give it to them.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it gave me chills.
Yeah, me too.
I actually did just want you to speak a little bit more about the inferior function, because when you were mentioning it, I didn't really understand what that...
Are you familiar with the Myers-Briggs type indicator?
Yes.
And have you taken it?
Yes.
Okay, and you get some letters, so... are you...
like INTJ.
INTJ,
like
okay. So introverted intuitive thinking with J is the judging. So S is the inferior function. INT, so the inferior functions would be sensation and feeling. Feeling can also be a doorway for a thinking type to the unconscious. It doesn't have to be the fourth function. Jung called the fourth function the inferior function. The second function is the auxiliary function and tertiary function. These are on an axis. So we have the superior function is intuition. If you're an intuitive type, and the what John Beebe, my mentor, calls the spine of the personality would connect you to the ground of your nature. That would be the sensation function. And that's why I was a cook, I think, you know, and why I ran track and why I love nature. I think it connects me to my body self. And I think that is the inferior function for me. So the inferior function would be the opposite of your typically your vocation comes through your superior function. That's what Jung called the heroic function. But at midlife, the hero function undergoes a sacrifice. Okay, and that is a very painful process of having to accept the wholeness of the personality. That the task of midlife is not about one-sidedness. It is about the feminine. It's about completeness, and it's about wholeness, and it's about nature. It's about being held by the Divine Mother, you could say, the cosmos itself. And so the way to get there is through, for the intuitive, is through the sensation function. And a calling can come through the sensate functions. For example, the park ranger. I mean, she's a part of my psyche. I mean, I love to work, you know, in the park. You know, I'm right on the border of Joaquin Miller Park, so there's no boundary between my house and the park. Just a trail. Did that help?
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. The thing about Isis and Notre Dame. Well, Notre Dame means Our Lady. You kind
yes.
of wonder if there's a connection there. And Catholicism, you know, Mary's, technically she's not part of the Godhead.
No.
You know, technically. But yet in cultural Catholicism, she's actually, among many Catholics, given more veneration than the Godhead is. So it's a kind of a weird, weird thing. But theologically, Catholics would, you know, the Catholic Church would deny it. But in practically speaking, many Catholics pay more attention to Mary than God, you know, mm-hmm. which is kind of interesting, too.
Particularly in South and Central America and Mexico.
Yeah. Southern Europe, where my ancestry is from, it's all Mary. Mm-hmm. I don't know what Notre Dame is. It's probably
Our Lady is different than Our Mother, right?
Say that again?
Our Lady is different than Our Mother.
Or no, the lady, I don't know why the term is used so
Mary
much.
Mary was referred to as Our Lady, I believe, too. But I think it's an important distinction.
Our
now,
lady
this
of
was
this,
a
de- lady
she
of
was
that.
A deacon. She wasn't necessarily the mother, but she was the channel for the mother. She was mm-hmm. the she received the divine light. In the dream.
I have a question from another psychotherapist here.
Another psych. Hello.
Brother Antoninus.
Brother Antoninus.
Is William Everson you were speaking of?
Yes.
Right. Yeah, I happened to go to a lecture.
Did you?
That he gave at Yale in the 60s.
Wow.
And I really just connected with his poetry and nature.
Mm.
And it's a big part of a path that led me back to coming back to this area. But
wow.
Just, you know,
another
it's
interesting
the only time
connection.
I met him.
Yeah.
And he had such a profound effect on me. Yeah.
Thank you for that. He was part of the reason why you came back to this area? Is that what you said?
Yeah, because I connected with his poetry, nature through his poetry.
That's pretty profound. Yeah.
You may already know this, but in Christian theology, as you study the Trinity, the Holy Spirit is a feminine demacular. The Greek is feminine. And it's greatly represented that way, Presbyterian and Episcopal Church, in looking at more the mothering of the Godhead.
Thank you for that. I didn't know that.
And there are Roman Catholic women priests. There's a documentary, Pink Smoke Over the Vatican.
How long have they been priests?
Maybe 10 years or 15 years.
Interesting.
They are excommunicated from the traditional Catholic Church.
Oh, yes, I believe I did see something about them.
And there was a recently ordained woman priest over in Orinda.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Times are changing, fortunately. Going back, yes. Right. It's a movement back to our origins.
I feel called to share something else and perhaps get some reflections because this is apparently a very wise group. My husband is Catholic, and we met in Peru, and I'm technically Hindu. And after we came out here, I had a spiritual awakening after my son was born. And after coming out here, that's when I fell into the lap of the Divine Mother and the Divine Feminine. And it triggered my husband a lot, being Catholic, South American Catholic on top of that. But I found some strength to own it, and he's actually embraced it. And in fact, he's in Italy right now because he's felt called to Italy. And he told me he had a dream that Mother Mary was assassinated by the Catholic Church. And so I was like, you need to go. he also had several dreams about Saint Bernardine. I'm not sure. So, I'm not connected to Catholicism in that way. I'm sure many lifetimes ago. So I'm just sharing it because, like I said, you're a wise group, and I feel like we're a collective. And
thank you for that. I just want to comment on what you just shared regarding the power of the Divine Mother in India, in the largest democracy in the world now, and the incredible influence that both Ramakrishna, who worshipped Kali, the Divine Mother, and was visited by her numerous times, and Swami Vivekananda, who I talked to this group about before, brought to our country in 1900 when he started the Vedanta Center in San Francisco. So this idea of the feminine in religion, in theology, really has its roots here in the Bay Area in 1900 with Vivekananda's talks on the feminine and the divine feminine, the divine mother. And assassination of the mother of Mary.
Okay.
Yeah, it seems like an interesting.
I think we have time for one more comment.
Yes,
just a very quick one. It's interesting in Judaism. There's an official name for both the male. There are a number of names for the male, but there's the Shekinah, which is absolutely the feminine.
Definitely.
And the Shekinah is invoked.
Yes.
I don't know. So just my comment.
Yeah. There's the Shekhinah, and then there's the Shulamite, too, in the Song of Solomon, that, you know, this, the importance of the feminine was definitely there in Judaism and Christianity. And I think both Meister Eckhart and Hildegard of Bingen really brought this in to our awareness. But all the churches, I think, in Europe were very much, as I think this gentleman pointed out about Notre Dame, there was a real definite sense of the presence of the divine feminine in Christianity generally, I think, in the medieval period in Europe. And
May
you learn how to dream.
Yes. And I don't know your name, but I want to thank you for your participation and stick around and talk to people. Thank you so much,
Stephen. Thank you so much for having me, Barbara. Yeah. Thank you.